This piece was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, SurreyFarms.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizzeria, where in Bushwick, Brooklyn, joined as usual with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah? You know, Stas has been busy these days working on marketing stuff for this Sears. All. How's it going there, Stas?
Fine? Yeah.
It's doing all right, actually, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Should be getting another shipment in, hopefully, like March, right?
Yeah, March.
I hope so. And hopefully, no promises, because I can't promise anything, because I'm not building this stuff myself. Like, Stas and I don't have the ability to build them ourselves, which is why we can't promise dates. But hopefully, in that shipment will also come the steak decorators, people, for those of you that we owe steak decorators to. So I'm very excited about that. Anyways, we also are joined with our master blaster of engineering, Jack Inslee.
Hello.
Oh, nice. You see, when you're actually running it, you can put the reverb on whenever you want. How you doing, Jack?
Yeah, I can. I'm feeling a little under the weather, but I'm all right.
Yeah? Is that why you need the reverb? You need the reverb to get yourself pumped up there?
I can do a lot of things with my voice on here. Did you know that?
No, let's see something.
I can do this.
What the what? Wait, do that again.
Hello.
Whoa.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I got some tricks left.
Wait, now, so, like, what's interesting about that one is it's not temporally shifted, it's just pitch shifted. So it's not
right.
Like what they used to do with, like, Funkadelic, where they actually would just speed the track up by, like, one or two, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right,
right. Oh, man. Can you go the other way? Can you go helium?
I can do it
while I talk.
Oh, my God, you can be the Yonkers Raceway guy now.
That's true.
Oh, my God. We're going to need to, okay, we're not going to do this to you people, like, live while you're listening, but we're going to come up with a choreography of craziness that we're going to start,
Cooking Issues.
We're just going to do, like up and down, like, oh, my God, we can do all sorts of parliament arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
We have to come up with our own kind of P-Funk-style mythology. Like, you know, Stas is, like, vegan face, devoid of funk. Devoid of funk. All right. So this week, what do we have? We don't have anything special going on this week. It's a mellow week. Nice. Although I am going to be asking requests for people, because over the next couple of months before the spring, I am going to be finally, after like 20 years, I'm finally going to be building an outdoor kitchen.
Ooh.
Yeah, right. So I need, first of all, there's going to be a deep fryer out there, because I put my fryer where my mouth is, you know what I'm saying? I tell other people to put an outdoor fryer, and I am going to put an outdoor fryer in. But I think that might be the only gas-fired thing I have out there. I'm going to maybe put a gas assist on the fire pit, but check out what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a standard fire pit, right? But I also want integrated into this big thing a tandoor. You know, Lucas, longtime listener Lucas, a museum supporter, he's building a tandoor right now, and a bread oven. Maybe, as much as I rib them, maybe Quebecois-style bread oven. So a bread oven, you know, masonry, retained heat, masonry oven, fire pit, tandoor, and here's the last one. This is the unusual one, because everyone builds a tandoor outside. I'm going to put a cruticula in that son of a gun. So a cruticula is the Roman kind of cooking platform. So it's weird. It's outdoors. It looks like a fireplace, right? So it's like looks like a mantle, like a flat thing. And underneath it is an arch-shaped thing that looks like a fireplace, right? Right? So it's like imagine like a little mini Arc de Triomphe with like a flat tabletop on top without all the, you know, the ornamentation and crap, right? But here's the weird Roman thing is that they don't build a fire in the arch and cook in the arch. They store wood in the arch, and they build the fire directly on top of the table surface. And they cook on this table surface. And years ago, Johnny Azzini and I did a video shoot where we were imitating Roman cooking, and we built one, like a cruticula, and we were cooking on top of it. And I actually really liked it. It's kind of fun because, you know, like instead of like reaching into a fire pit or reaching into an oven, it's like the fire is literally right there, and you can move around it and like all the way around it, and you can like shift stuff around in kind of a cool way. So I kind of liked it. So I'm going to do that because you know what? Because I can. because I freaking can. And another thing I'm doing, we talk about before I get to the questions. Oh, by the way, should you have questions, you can always call them in to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So, I like espresso. I love espresso. Espresso's good. Do you like espresso, Stas? Or, but do you drink it straight? No, you drink like lattes or you drink like macchiato? What do you drink?
I drink from the Mr. Coffee.
No, no. Espresso. You said espresso. Oh. When you're going to have an espresso beverage.
I can have it all.
But do you like straight espresso? Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, I don't really like... it's not that I don't like it. I don't go out of my way for like super drip or like, you know, pour overs or... Pour over sounds like comb over to me. I know it's like super popular now. We had a good one at that Japanese style coffee place.
Yeah.
Stas gave a because it just took forever. It took for freaking ever. But I'm fine with that. You know, I enjoy all this stuff and I enjoy, but really my heart's in espresso. But I haven't had a chance to update my espresso game in many, many years because I had a spending kibosh dropped on me, you know, and because I already had a fairly decent setup. So now I'm also, and you guys will, I'll regale you with the stories when it happens, I'm updating my espresso rig. Now, the trick with espresso, the mistake that people make, right? Espresso, and I've said this a billion times, is all about control and repeatability of a fairly small range of variables, but it turns out it's more difficult than you'd think to control them all very well. So I updated my my roasting setup because you know how I roast coffee, Stas? Mm-hmm. You know I'm trying to save money now, so I went back to roasting my own coffee, and I use what's called a Whirly Pop. So you know the popcorn maker that you put on the stove and you twist it and it goes, mm-hmm. and it pops and it's this aluminum Whirly Pop thing. So a lot of people, I used to pop with air popcorn poppers. I had dedicated air roasters, and I burnt out every single one that I ever had. Every single one I burnt out. The Whirly Pop, it don't ever burn out. It just doesn't burn out, you know what I mean? And they've superseded that, you know, with home roasters now. They have home roasters now that almost act like mini drum machines. They're awesome, but I can't afford them. Whirly Pop is like $15, right? But you know what I hate about the Whirly Pop? The Whirly Pop, you have to crank it all the time. So, like, let's say all of a sudden your nose starts to run. Can you go get a Kleenex? No, because you have to turn it all the time. Because if you don't turn it all the time, it's going to burn. If something else happens, if the phone rings, can you answer the phone? No, you can't. Because if you do, it'll burn. Can you make a cup of coffee while you're doing it? No. Like, can you take the last of the stuff that you had while you're roasting the new stuff and make? No, right? Which sucks. It's terrible. And it's like 10 or 12 minutes of time when you can sit there and do nothing else. And then another couple of minutes cooling it down afterwards, like putting the beans back and forth after you roast them. So... Stas and I have an Ultimaker for Booker and Dax for prototyping. So I probably I went off the reservation. I mean, I didn't really use it for work in this application, but I printed out a little housing. I chopped off the end of the Whirly Pop thing, left a little bit of the handle that you crank on it. It chopped off enough so I could get a straight piece, you know, because the handle's bent, if you could picture it in your head. Chopped it off, and then I put a little, like, 12-volt DC motor I got on Amazon for, like, $6 and put it on there, printed a case that fit around and held it onto the handle so it wouldn't spin. Now that sucker's electric. Oh, yeah. So now, like, for, like, $8 or something, I have an electric Whirly Pop, and now... I can, you know, never roast coffee on a stove and leave it unattended. I'm not saying you do that, but I can now blow my nose, make a cup of coffee, move around, like get a drink of water while I'm doing it. It's just so much more civilized. I can't believe it took me years to do this, but it's all because you know how you don't do anything for a long time, you stay in stasis, right? And then all of a sudden you get a kick in the butt and you just do everything all at once. Well, it's like that with the coffee. So because I'm getting this new place, I need a new coffee grinder, right? Now, the coffee grinder I have is called the Rancilio Rocky, and it's like, at the time, it was, you know, I couldn't believe I was spending that kind of money on a grinder. It was like $300 or $350 or something, and it was the highest kind of level grinder that any home jockey was getting, because this was like 12 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, something like this, like 12 maybe, and maybe more, jeez, I might have gotten it before Booker was born, I don't remember. Anyways, it was kind of like it, you know? But now people are getting much kind of higher level grinders, but no one is – well, that's not true. There's plenty of rich people out there, but not very many people now are buying the highest level of grinder, like the Titan series are called grinders, like the very large ones with the very large burrs in them. And it turns out they make everyone who uses them says they make superior espresso. They're huge and they're expensive, like thousands of dollars, right? So am I going to buy that?
I don't know.
No, I'm not going to buy that. What am I, crazy? I'm going to buy it. But it, you know, everyone spends all their money on the espresso machine, but not on the grinder, which is a huge, huge error, because the world's greatest espresso machine with a crappy grinder, you're very limited in what you're going to produce in terms of quality espresso. So it turns out that there is this lunatic company called Orphan Espresso out of Idaho, right? And it's a husband and wife team. I think they're husband and wife. And they just make these crazy grinders that have really high quality burr sets in hand grinders. So they make, unfortunately, it's always out of stock because they don't really give a crap. It's called the Pharos, and I can't get one right now because they're out of stock. And what happens is that they get the parts in for like 40 or 50 of them. They put it on and they sell out like this. And then when they're gone, it's like, and they never tell you it's going to happen. And people, I understand that because you know what? They probably hate doing customer service. I'm with them. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not blaming them. It's just I wish I could get one, you know. So they have a grinder set. First of all, this grinder called the Pharos, the Orphan Espresso Pharos, it's only $245, which seems like, oh, that's a lot. But the I can't buy just the burrs because I looked into DIYing one. I can't buy the burrs for less than like $150. So I don't know how they're building the whole grinder for $245 because they're building a grinder that has the same burr set in it. It's called the Coney is the name of the grinder, Mazer Coney. And it's like, I think it's like a $4,000 grinder or something like this. And for $245, you can get that same grind quality. It just put a little elbow grease into it. I got their next down in line one because that one's always in stock called the Lido 2. And I have to say, my espresso quality has jumped up. I might have to get one for my home rig. Anyway, later I'll talk about, because I'm finally going to pimp out the Ranchillo Silvia, which is, you know, the kind of it's kind of the 39 Merc of espresso machines in that everybody, you know, everyone kind of tricks out the Silvia because it's really easy to trick out. So everyone's done PID, which is, you know, the temperature control loops, and people have done everything to it. So I'm not going to be treading on any new water in it, but I'll go through the kind of modifications that I've done to the Silvia and I'll report back as it happens. But that's probably going to take a couple of months because I'm only going to be doing it in drips and drabs here and there. Anyway, so that's my coffee report and my my other report. Should we get on to some questions? Yeah. Okay. Stephen Hoppy, he says last name pronounced Hop-E, if you care to know, which I do. I like that, Hoppy. But like Hop, like with a capital E, which I also like. Like because when it's, if it's H-O-P-E, that the capital E means it's pronounced E like easy E, right? Hoppy. Anyway, from Chicago, writes in about centrifuges. Hey, Dave, Nastasia, Jack, and anyone else who might be present. No one. Only got the hard course. I'm hoping to purchase a centrifuge that I hope to use in a bar I'm in the process of developing, and found what looks to be a decent one for sale at a good price. It's for those of you that know, it's a made by Fisher, and it's you know, there's Fisher is really a catalog. They don't really make anything. I think that's my impression of them, but it's about $1,000, which for a 3-liter centrifuge is pretty good. Anyway, so here's the question. There are a couple of things about this model that give me pause. For one, as you can see if you follow the link, you can't because you're on the radio. and I'm not going to give you guys the link because if I give you the link, then maybe someone else would buy it out from underneath Steven, and that would not be fair. Would that be fair?
Mm-mm.
Would not be fair. It only does 3,000 times the force of gravity, and I know that you use a centrifuge that gets to 4,000. On top of that, this model is not refrigerated. I think that the lower G-force will just mean the product will take more time to form a puck, but I don't know how much longer and if this will be a problem. If purchased, this will be used in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Never been. You ever been?
Mm-mm.
I'd like to go. Wouldn't you like to go? Someone I know was just in Puerto Rico.
Piper.
I didn't know he was in Puerto Rico. When was he in Puerto Rico?
When he worked with us.
No, no, but I mean, I know someone who just, like, literally just got back from Puerto Rico. Someone in Booker and Dex, maybe? Anyway. And I have a slight concern about the product heating up too much in Puerto Rico. I get you. If it's going to take much longer for a puck formation in a hot, humid environment. Does this seem like too large a caveat to make the purchase? Thanks for the help and for everything else you do. Listening to Cooking Issues has inspired and emboldened me to give up cabinetry and take on bar management. Well, I think cabinetry is a great profession. I mean, I'm not saying you should go back to it, but a lot of honor in doing good woodwork. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I like good woodwork. Cheers, Stephen from Chicago, although I guess in the future, shortly, you know, we'll be in San Juan. So here's my thoughts. So for those of you out there that don't have the link, this is a spinning bucket centrifuge. And remember, centrifuge is separating products based on density. It spins around really quickly and the denser stuff goes to the outside of the spinning rotor, and the lighter stuff gets pushed up to the inner side of the spinning rotor, where the forces of gravity are, well, the centripetal force is less, right? Now, here's what you need to know. First of all, on refrigeration, the spinning from the rotor does generate a significant amount of heat. So if you're going to be spinning, things get pretty warm. Now, that said, I know plenty of people like Wiley Dufresne. His centrifuge is not refrigerated, and he's had good luck with it. But you do need to do a couple of things. You need to chill your buckets down beforehand. So sometimes I would put ice water in them when I used a non-refrigerated centrifuge, and just get everything cold beforehand. You can store a little – don't ever put anything into the cabinet while it's spinning, because it can get kicked up and just a nightmare. Don't ever do that. But you can put ice into the like bags of ice into the centrifuge cabinet while it's not spinning to get it nice and cold beforehand, and that can help a little bit. So if your buckets start cold and your product starts cold and your centrifuge starts cold, and you might not need to do all of those things, you have a good chance of having the stuff not get too hot. But I'll just give you an idea. When something spins for like 15 or 20 minutes without a refrigerator and everything starts out at room temperature, you can get, you know, up above, slightly above body temp, you know, up into like yeast proofing temperatures when you spin. So the temperature rise is appreciable, and the longer it stays in, obviously, the higher the temperature is going to go. So that's, you know, what you're dealing with if you're talking about not having a refrigerator. It's not insurmountable. It's not something that you know, I would, if I could choose refrigeration, would I have it? Yeah. You know, would I not buy a centrifuge because it didn't have a fridge? No. And the advantage of not having a fridge is that centrifuges with fridges are a lot heavier, they cost more, and they're a lot bigger. They take up a lot more space, and they take more power. So these are, you know, three things that aren't necessary, and they throw more heat off into your kitchen, because remember, any refrigerator in your kitchen is throwing off heat. That's how it's making things cold on the inside. Okay, so that's that. And if you're a real DIY modder, I'm not going to recommend that you modify a centrifuge. What the hell, am I crazy? What am I, crazy? Nuts? Dave said I could modify the centrifuge, and it blew up and killed everyone in my restaurant, you know?
Yeah.
See, now that I deal with these corporate weasels all the time, like I have to think like a corporate weasel sometimes, mm-hmm. which is kind of depressing.
Mm-hmm.
Stas is like, Who are you? I don't even know you anymore. I can't believe you moderated something you were going to say based on corporate weasel think.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we all get worse as we get older, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not like fine wines as it happens. So the other question is about the G-forces involved. Okay. Here's the thing. On a spinning bucket centrifuge, I find that you need a higher G-force than you do in a fixed-angle rotor. So a fixed-angle rotor is one where you have tubes or vials or whatever, and they're kept at a fixed angle, right? Duh, fixed-angle rotor. And what happens is at that fixed angle, particles that are getting spun out of the solution, they're not in solution, but getting desuspended, let's say, and turned into a puck, they hit that side wall of the fixed angle rotor, and then they scour themselves down that angle and compact into a nice pellet, right? So fixed angle rotors can form a nice pellet at fairly low G forces, whereas a spinning and there's typically less distance that that the particles have to travel before they hit that wall, so it spins out faster. Spinning bucket rotors, they can separate fairly quickly, but they don't compact as hard when they're hitting, because they're basically just settling onto a flat thing, and then they have to push. There's no kind of scouring action down into it. So when a spinning bucket rotor slows down, which is when the problems happen, they tend to kick stuff back up into the product, and they tend to cloud. So back when, you know, when my centrifuges are running closer to 3,000 Gs, like when the bearings are getting shot, things tend to be a little cloudier. Is it still going to work? Yes. Can you still carbonate with it? Yes. Does it make me super happy? Do I wake up with a big smile on my face thinking about a centrifuge that can only run at 3,000 Gs? No. You know what I mean? But that said, you know, it's definitely going to be worthwhile And certain things are going to clarify at 3,000 Gs, no problem, like Banana Justino, which is a clarification monster. But other things that are on the verge of not clarifying or that have very fine sediment that tends to kick up, you might have some problems, and spinning longer might solve them or it might not. But, you know, it seems like it's a fairly small centrifuge, and it's, you know, might be worth the money if you can get it for $1,000. The ones that I used to get for really cheap, the Juans, don't seem to be as available as they used to be. But here's the other thing I'm going to recommend. If you're going to buy a used centrifuge for a bar program, don't count on it to survive. You must get a backup unit. Okay, you must get a backup unit, or you must train your bar staff to be able to do alternate techniques like agar clarification. But agar clarification is not going to work if you're doing things like Justino. So, you know, a new centrifuge, is it going to break? Probably not. It's $8,000, right? That's just facts. But a used centrifuge, don't think you can get away with a $1,000 one used centrifuge, because that sucker will break. I'm telling you from experience, it will break. And the odds that someone at the bar, if you're not there, is able to fix it themselves is low for two reasons. Not that many people are trained in fixing centrifuges or have the kind of mechanical, I'm just going to freaking do this thing and fix it. And even if they did, what are the odds that someone who's working for you feels comfortable ripping apart your centrifuge? Because what if they mess it up? You know what I'm saying? So it's very hard to get someone at the bar to be able to do something like fix a centrifuge for you. So if you're not willing to fix it, or you're not able to get there instantly to fix it if it goes down, or if you don't have some sort of, you know, way that you don't need those menu items on a regular basis, then get a backup. Yeah.
Did you fix it yesterday?
Yes. So what I'm saying, we had one that was broken yesterday. It was the brushes that went bad, and I might need to replace it again, but I was able to get it to run no problem. Look, it's the kind of thing. It's like, you know, I know that Stas and I said that we weren't going to be, you know, duct tape and bubble gum.
When you did the brushes last time, is that when it was like balancing on two things and you had it like it was underneath?
It's still like that. Yeah. Well,
no,
this is
like on.
Yeah, on a sheet tray.
Yeah.
That didn't fit on.
Right.
Yeah, this one, it's like, I mean, look, if you guys knew the kind of like real dumb way that we have to do things 9 times out of 10, the funniest thing ever happened, I forget who it was, somebody once like said that, they accused us of like having all this like awesome equipment and like cushy everything, and while that thing came in, I think I was literally lifting a centrifuge by myself, like, up to a place over my head so I could go underneath it and work on the motor. Remember that day? Oh, my God. Anyway, you know, again, like, we're not as duct tape as we were before, though, right? Stas, we're getting a little better.
Yeah,
but whatever. It's like Jack. You know how we've had this conversation a billion times, but it's always worth having again. You know how in a band you keep on saying that someday someone else is going to move your equipment for you?
Yeah.
Does that ever happen?
Yes.
Wait, you have other people moving your equipment now?
No, I mean, not fully, but sometimes in some gigs, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, I was all about that. I was like, I'm going to get to the point in my life where someone's going to carry my bass rig around. No, you won't. No, you won't. You know, and it's the same thing with our crap. It's the same thing with the cooking crap. You just never get there. All right. Brian Haggerty writes in from Minneapolis. And by the way, he says at the end that we were wondering about it once, that the abbreviation for Minneapolis, MPLS. Did you know that?
I saw
really?
That.
Yeah. Mipples. See, it doesn't make sense. I don't get Minneapolis.
NYC, you get.
NYC, you get New York City. But Mini.
MNPS?
No, MPLS.
NPLS.
M like Minnesota or Minneapolis.
Oh, gotcha.
P like political science.
Yeah.
L like latrine. S like sandwich.
Got it.
Mipples. But, like, the thing is, I don't know, like, M-I-P-S or something, MIPS? I don't know, like, Mipples? There's no N. To me, Minneapolis is about the N's, right? Minneapolis. This is just Mipples.
Mm-hmm. How about an M-N-P?
M-N-P, or M-N-P-S, Minipus, Minipus? Mm-hmm. I don't know, dude. How about just Minneapolis?
Yeah.
I'm looking at the word Minneapolis next to Mipples, and I'm not feeling it. You feeling it?
No. It's just not. No. No.
No. Right?
No.
No. No. No. No. At first, I thought it was like some sort of contraction of like Minneapolis-St. Paul, like a kind of twin city thing. But it's not. It's literally just Minneapolis. Crap on those St. Paul people. It's not even in there. You know what I mean? Whatever. Mipples. I kind of like it. Now I have in my head, you know, like at the beginning of a lot of rap songs, they'll be like, mipples, 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 mipples. You know what I mean? Like like Public Enemy used to do that. All, but they wouldn't say mipples. They'd be like, what's that song? Here come the drums. It's off. I'll look it up. Anyway, but that's what I have going through my head. I have someone like, mippy, mippy, mip. Oh, I know. It's that. Never mind. I'm not going to get into it. It's off of 91. What is it? The 91, the Enemy Strikes Black or The Empire Strikes Black?
I don't know.
Remember that album, Jack? Anyway. Brian Haggerty writes in, regarding Chia. I recently discovered your show, and I'm loving it. I'm wondering if you had any... Well, thank you. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts about the usefulness of chia seeds. Taz, can you do the chia song for me?
No.
Come on. Jack, can you do the chia song? Am I going to have to do it? I don't want to do it.
You're going to have to do it.
Chia. Okay. Did you used to do those things when you were a kid?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? You know what? The most recently, I had a new old stock. This was maybe 10 years ago. Mr. T Chia Head. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. His mohawk is perfect because it's got the ridges in it to mm-hmm. hold the chia seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do chia pets when you were a kid, Jack?
Mm-mm.
Why not? What the hell's wrong with you?
I don't know.
You don't like chia
Deprived.
Pets? So, do you like a classic chia pet? Or do you like some weird chia pets?
No, classic. I had the classic.
Not like some sort of Homer Simpson growing mm-hmm. hair thing?
Mm-mm.
No? Classic. I imagine. That seems like a very California thing.
They have chia seeds in disgusting stuff now. Like in juices.
Well, that's what we're about to talk about. Oh. Do you prefer basil seeds?
I had my first one 2 days ago, and I thought it was disgusting. The texture. Have you had it?
It's like mucilage.
It's gross.
In a beverage, people like
yeah.
it.
I thought it was gonna be like because it was raspberry flavored that it would be. I like raspberry seeds, you know, so I could like crunch.
Yeah, but raspberry seeds, and we're about to talk about this, are very different from chia seeds.
I know. I didn't know that. So
yeah, hugely like different.
Gross. Gross. Gross.
What are your actual thoughts? Gross, gross. She's not, are you going to have a new face just for chia seeds?
It's still sitting in my fridge.
It's still sitting in your fridge? You couldn't convince anyone to drink that?
No. No.
How xanthan looking is it?
Not very xanthan looking, but the texture is very.
Yeah, very xanthan. Yeah. So we'll get into it. So anyway, I recently, as you know, okay. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about the usefulness of chia seeds. Backing up so people know, because obviously I went off on a tangent because I cannot help myself. As I'm sure you know, they absorb a ton of water and form a weird gel. Would you say that's accurate, Stas?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Weird gel. She's got her weird gel face on, her chia gel face, her trying to keep it down in her mind face mm-hmm. on. Various vegan folks suggest – I like that. Various vegan folks. It's got a good ring to it. You have good alliterative prose, Brian. Various vegan folks suggest using a slurry of ground chia seeds, and water, 1 tablespoon of ground seeds to 3 tablespoons of water in place of an egg. Yeah? Okay. I have used chia seeds in turkey meatloaf to good effect. America's Test Kitchen has a turkey burger recipe that calls for gelatin to offset the dryness of the turkey. Or you could just not overcook the freaking turkey, America's Test Kitchen. This is why turkey burgers suck so hard. They always are over freaking cooked. Why do people do this? It's like salmon burgers. Ugh. Like someone serves you a salmon burger and they overcook the piss out of it because salmon burgers... Like, theoretically, a salmon burger is a good idea, right? Except for they always make it too far in advance. The sucker oxidizes. You get that oxidized salmon flavor, and it's overcooked into a dry puck. And they do the same thing with the turkey burger. So when they order the turkey burger out, I'm like, don't order the turkey burger. Don't do it. You know what I mean? Anyways. But you can make a good turkey burger without using chia seeds or gelatin if you just take care. Whatever, I'm not going to get into that. We're not talking about that right now. Okay. Back to the question. I have used chia seeds and turkey meatloaf to good effect. America's Test Kitchen has a turkey burger recipe that calls for gelatin to offset the dryness of the turkey. So I figured I'd use chia slurry. How do you like that word?
No.
Chia slurry. Instead of gelatin. I also mixed in ground dry chia seeds on the theory that as the meat cooked and released its juices, those juices might be captured by the chia seeds and thus be retained in the loaf. I don't know if this mechanism functioned, but I do know the finished product was juicy and delicious. Awesome. Awesome. That's good. I used chia seeds in crepe batter in place of eggs to weird effect. The seeds thickened the batter like crazy, so I added a ton of water plus some oil to thin it down, and it cooked up strangely with lots of holes that developed as the water evaporated. The taste was not bad, but it wasn't much like a crepe. Yeah, so remember, you know, you don't want a lot of, like, you know, big, like, injera-style bubbles in a crepe. And this kind of xanthan-y effect is going to have a different water hold. So you should think of chia like a xanthan because it forms a mucilaginous slime. And literally, like, technically, they're like, it forms a mucilaginous slime, much like xanthan does. So you're going to get, you know how, like, you remember when we used to foam xanthan foams for demo styles? You get those big holes in them because of the way it holds. I don't know if it technically forms, I don't know if the gel, because of what I was reading, has what's called a yield point, which I'll get to in a minute. But so things like xanthan have a yield point, so they actually act like a solid, a gel up to a particular amount of force being applied, and then they shear thin rapidly. I know that chia, from the research I was doing, is rapidly shear thinning, but I don't know kind of how much of a yield point it has. Anyway, yield point is really good for things like eggs. So I'm imagining it does have a yield point. Because that's why xanthan is so good at replacing eggs, because it's not a protein, but it has a yield point, so it can hold things pretty well. So the taste was not bad, but wasn't much like a crepe. Anyway, modernist cuisine, modernist cooking uses all kinds of weird gelling agents, but I haven't seen very much about chia gel in the modernist cooking-related stuff I've read so far. For instance, Science Fair, which is like Naveen and Kevin and those guys. No, the Harvard or ex-Harvard guys, because they're not at Harvard anymore, right?
Yeah.
They're gone. They have a long list of hydrocolloid and hydrocolloid enablers, but chia seeds not on the list. I'm interested in your thoughts, Brian Haggerty. Okay, so, look, the interesting thing is, oh, by the way, before I get started, just take a look at this document. It's open source, so you can get it on the internet. The International Journal of Food Science, volume 2014, article 241053. It's called Chemical and Functional Properties of Chia Seed, Salvia Hispanica Gum by Myra Ruby Segura Campos et al. It's available online. It's a good read. And interestingly, you know, what they said that I found interesting is that it was used in Aztec ceremonies, chia seeds, for a long time. And their argument, and I haven't researched the history of it enough, is that it's literally because it had religious significance that when the conquistadors came in and wiped out all traces of religious ceremony, that chia was kind of expunged. And that's why it wasn't used very much in that kind of stuff for a long time, even though it remained a traditional foodstuff. But that chia seeds was an incredibly important foodstuff, like in the words of the article, less than corn, less important than corn, but more important than amaranth. Interesting. So almost all hydrocolloids are natural things that are extracted either from fermentation, like xanthan or gelan. So, you know, a bacteria or a fungus is making a slime, and that slime is then, you know, purified and turned into a gum. Or from things like seeds. So guar seed, locust bean seed. That's how we come up with hydrocolloids. But the interesting thing is that there are a lot of seeds out there that have hydrocolloid properties in them that have just never been really researched from an industrial standpoint. Sometimes it's because there's not enough production out there, and sometimes it's just an oversight. And so this article is saying that they believe that chia seeds do have the ability to have some commercialization in terms of their use, because they can be grown in places where other things aren't necessarily going to grow very well, and they have some interesting properties. So what are those properties? Chia seed forms a slimy gel at very low concentrations, as Nastasia knows from her raspberry drink. But also what's interesting about chia seeds is chia seeds were an important dietary item because they're very high in oil. So it's a very like they're 39% oil, very high oil percentage. And if you soak the chia seeds or grind them and you get this mucilaginous sludge is mainly formed by a polysaccharide, as all hydrocolloids are. But it also has a large protein component in it, the way that gum arabic does, and a very high oil component in it. And that combination, that kind of triple threat of oil and oil and polysaccharide and protein, means that it not only can hold and absorb water, but it can hold and absorb oil. And they think because of the protein also can emulsify. So you can use it as an emulsifier. Hence, it's a good, maybe a good replacer for something like eggs. I haven't experimented with it, so this is all just this article, but I'm pretty interested in it. Unfortunately, to get the pure hydrocolloid, and by the way, the yield of this gum is fairly high, like on the order of 10-11% by weight of the chia seed, right? So like a good bit of it is functional. Then the rest of it you have to deal with is the seed and all that other stuff. Most of the – they think that most of these properties are concentrated in the outer coat, near the edge of the seed. Anyways, unfortunately, to produce it the way they produced it in the article, you have to soak the seeds, blend them. Then you have to like heat it at 50°C, and then you have to spin it at 10,000 times the force of gravity for like 3 or 4 hours to get to separate the seeds out from the gum, and then you can dry it and have the gum. So, interesting, but I've never used it, but it is very interesting. Maybe because they suggest maybe making mayonnaises with it or anything that needs emulsifying or oil holding, but you don't want to use things like eggs. Anyway. So we got a quick two questions in. Jared writes in about ISIs. With respect to flavor extraction into alcohol and oil, how do chamber vacuums and ISI EC whippers differ? And if you could start with only one, which is preferred, or is there a better option than either of them, especially for long-term shelf life of the flavor? Does alcohol percentage or oil type matter? What else should be considered? Thanks very much. Okay. I'm not going to push my book, except for I go into like excruciating detail in the book on this kind of stuff. And so I'm not going to be able to go as in depth here. I will say this. Yes, alcohol percentage matters. Higher or lower alcohol isn't necessarily better or worse, but higher alcohol is going to extract things quicker, right? So it all depends on what kind of a flavor. It's like anything else. There's no better. There is no good guys. There is no bad guys. Just you and me, Stas, and we just disagree. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She likes that song. She's bopping to that one. We all know that's a good tune. Anyway, oil type I don't think is going to matter as much, except for, I guess, obviously, if something's a solid fat or liquid fat, so maybe it does matter. I don't have as much experience with that. I usually use neutrals or oil whose flavor I particularly like, something like olive oil. With respect to vacuum machine versus EC, the fundamental point is this. The EC is a lot more flexible. It has a lot more power to do infusions because the pressure differentials are a lot wider. You can do things like heat it in the EC. You can, put a much higher pressure differential. It's easier to deal with. That said, if you can deal with the lower pressure differentials that you're working on in a vacuum machine, which is only like 15 PSI, the advantage that a vacuum machine has is you can do a huge quantity at once. Like, depends on the size of your vacuum machine, but I've done like gallons at once. That's, 4 liters in units of 4 liters for you metric types. And, so it can do that kind of a thing. And to be able to do that with pressure, you would move away from an EC and you would get a 5-gallon Cornelius keg and you'd hook it up to a nitrous tank or in a pinch a CO2 tank if you had time to let it vent off. And you could do it that way. But if you could do it in an EC and you could afford the chargers, then I'd say it's a superior technique to using a vacuum. But it's a lot easier to experiment with the EC because the unit quantities are much smaller. So anyway, that's my feelings on it. But in the book I wrote so many – I can't even think about it anymore because of all the words I wrote in that freaking book. Stas won't even look at the book. As you all know, she uses it as kind of a McDLT hot food separator. Like that's – doesn't want to open it. I think she might have it taped shut so that she never has to see anything on the inside of it. But she says it's just thick enough to make sure that you never get the hot side mixing with the cold side. So it's – at least it's – and it's pretty flat, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't bend too much. Nope. So, I've done a good job right there. That's all I can hope for. Last in, Alvin Schultz. Our good friend Alvin Schultz writes in about eggnog. Hi, Dave, Hammer, Jack, Indie Jesus, Santa's Hipster, and friends. I've been inspired by Booker and Dax's Nick Bennett, and haven't we all been inspired by Nick Bennett, to make some aged eggnog for next year and years to come. Bennett just did a tasting recently of like three-year-old eggnog or something like this. I recently had a one-year-old eggnog from Hail Pale in PDX. It was delicious, and I didn't die. Good news. I'm glad you're not dead, Alvin. Dave, what's your thoughts on the safety of the two recipes listed below? Particularly, are my final ABV calculations correct, and should the mix be sterile and safe to drink after a year, plus if it's sealed in mason jars, not canned or cooked and stored and wrapped in foil at room temp? I wouldn't keep it in room temp. I keep it in the fridge. Wouldn't you, Stas? Mm-hmm. Why do they have to be room temp, Alvin? I don't know about room temp, because all those studies, I think, were in fridge. Although I have to ask Bennett how he stored it. I don't know. I didn't read that when I was reading it. And also, Alvin, your ABVs didn't come in. But Nick said he shook his a couple of times a month to keep it homogenized. I also plan on shaking it every so often. If it matters, I'll be using farm eggs, unpasteurized. I don't think it matters. The whole point is, if it's safe, it's safe no matter what kind of an egg you used. The guys at Rockefeller University, who famously did the study, I think in 2008, of the eggnogs that they have been making for 65 years based on a recipe that was handed down to them from someone who was born in like 1890, and she got it from her like grandma or something like that. That recipe, you know, that recipe they tested by inoculating the eggs and the whole batch with salmonella and seeing if it killed it. So the whole point is that if it's safe, it's going to be safe no matter what kind of an egg you use. So anyway, if it matters, I'll be using farm eggs and high quality dairy products from a local creamery. I'm also at high risk. I'm not at high risk for illness and or pregnancy. And the two recipes I'll be mixing are Michael Ruman's and George Washington's. Yeah, the George Washington. Washington's recipe omits the number of eggs used, so I calculated what Ruman's yolk ratio was and inserted it into Washington's booze dairy mix. All right, so I couldn't look at your calculations. They didn't come through on the email, Alvin. But what I would look up is Dr. Rebecca Lancefield's eggnog recipe. That's the one that was tested by Rockefeller University. That recipe is a dozen eggs, whole eggs, not yolks, whole eggs, a quart of heavy cream, 1 quart light cream, 1 pint bourbon, 1 quart rum, nutmeg, and a half pound to three quarter of a pound of sugar. So what you're looking at here, sugar is going to reduce the water activity and make it a little bit safer. And the egg's water activity is what it is. But in terms of the other things, you're looking at a quart of heavy cream and a quart of light cream, which has a lot of fat in it. So there's actually, like, you know, a good deal of not water in that too. But you're looking at, for that ratio, a pint of bourbon and a quart of rum. Okay, so a quart and a half of liquid for that level. George Washington's recipe is 1 quart of cream, 1 quart of milk. But who the hell knows what that means? Because that's like 1700s cream. Who the hell knows? You know what I mean? It wasn't getting it from a store. 1 dozen tablespoons sugar, which is like, what is that? A dozen tablespoons? It's like not quite a cup. What is that?
I don't know.
Well, it's 8 tablespoons in a stick of butter, and that's a half cup, right?
Mm-hmm.
So not quite a cup. Anyway, 1 pint – here's where we get the important part. 1 pint brandy, 1/2 pint rye whiskey, 1/2 pint Jamaica rum. So now we're at pint, half pint, full pint, quart, and 1/4 pint sherry. Then you mix that and you separate the yolks and the whites, which is interesting, and you beat in the yolks and then whip the egg whites up and fold them in. So you're looking at – Washington's recipe is a little less alcoholic than the other one. And he also only lets it sit for a couple of days, tasting frequently. So, I mean, I don't know whether Washington's recipe as written is safe. It's clearly a little less alcoholic than Dr. Rebecca Lancefield's eggnog, which is guaranteed safe because they ran a challenge test on it. But it's not that much less alcoholic. So you might, might be safe. I don't know. And then Ruhlmann's, 12 egg yolks, 2 cups granulated sugar, 1 liter of bourbon, only 4 cups milk and 1 cup heavy cream, and plus 3/4 cup of cognac and 1/2 cup of Myers dark rum and a pinch of salt. That's like super higher in alcohol content than the other one. So I'm going to go ahead and say that Ruhlmann's recipe is 100% guarantee. Obviously, Lancefield's recipe is a guarantee because they tested that sucker. And George Washington, I can't vouch for it, but probably if you let it sit around long enough, it's going to be safe. But I'm not going to guarantee it. But good old George Washington, he didn't die. He did, but not of that. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Thank you.